Not a lot of people know this, but the New Hampshire legislature is the oldest legislature in the country. I don't mean like historically it was founded the earliest. I mean the people in the legislature voting on bills, they're old. There's nothing wrong with that. But let's think about democracy. Can legislators represent New Hampshire if they don't, you know, literally represent us, if they don't look like us? From NHPR, this is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. Our show today tackles that question. What does representation mean? And who are the people trying to make our local governments more representative? First, a story from Daniela Ali about young people running for office. Daniela takes it from here.
It's a cloudy Friday, and Sophia Wazir is walking through her Concord neighborhood. It's known as the Heights. It's a mix of older people, young working families, new immigrants, and longtime residents. She's knocking on doors and leaving behind flyers that say she'll help bring a new generation to the State House.
Good afternoon, Mr. Silva.
How are you? How you doing? I'm glad to see you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you for supporting.
Yeah.
This is Wazir's first time running for political office. She wants to be a state rep. And she surprised herself and a lot of people in her neighborhood when she won her Democratic primary by a 2-to-1 margin over a well-known incumbent.
Your courage in doing this.
Thank you.
Because
I want to be your voice. That's all it mattered to me.
Wazir's 27. She's a mom to 2 daughters and pregnant with her 3rd. She's a relatively new U.S. citizen. She moved to the States at 16 after 10 years in a refugee camp in Uzbekistan, after she and her family escaped from the Taliban when she was just 6. Wazir remembers the help her family received when they moved to Concord from Uzbekistan. Volunteers would drive them to the grocery store or doctor's appointments.
It meant a lot to me, you know. Back then, I think that was really something that was touching my heart. I said, when I become a U.S. citizen, I want to be able to do the same thing.
If Wazir wins a seat in the New Hampshire House in November, she says she'll bring attention to issues like paid family medical leave, funding for public schools, and equal housing opportunities, all issues she's personally dealt with.
I want to be the voice of young people because, sadly, the New Hampshire is aging and we don't have enough of younger people. So that I want to show that younger people has the voice to do things in the New Hampshire.
With 400 state rep seats, it seemed like there are a lot of opportunities for young people like Wazir to get involved. But that's not the case.
In New Hampshire, we like to say we have a citizen legislature. We do. But it's a very select citizen legislature when you only get paid $100 to serve or $200 a term to serve.
That's Lucas Meyer. He's the president of the New Hampshire Young Democrats. He says it's a challenge to get people with young families or less flexible jobs to run because of the time commitment they have to make and how little they get paid. But this election year, both parties are trying to overcome those obstacles and get folks under the age of 40 in the legislature. Democrats are fielding 52 of those candidates and Republicans 47.
It was tough to be a young representative when there wasn't really any there wasn't a network of other young representatives that could band together and push our ideas forward.
Joe Sweeney knows what it feels like to be one of just a handful of young people in office. He's now the chair of the New Hampshire Young Republicans. He was just 19 when he served as state rep back in 2012. Colleagues mistook him for an intern until he got his official name badge. He says back then, there were about 10 other young people in office. So when it came to topics like student debt or bills addressing first-time homebuyers, most legislators didn't fully understand how things have really changed for people in their 20s and 30s.
I think being a 21-year-old or a 22-year-old in 2018 is very different if you had that experience back in 1980. I think the outlook's different. I think we know that we have student loan debt that nobody else can really compare to. I know I have about $80,000 in student loan debt after my undergrad and my master's degree. But I just think at the end of the day that representation matters.
One candidate Sweeney hopes gets a chance this November is Virginia Dry. She's the youngest candidate running for office in New Hampshire.
I'm 19, a Republican and a woman, and I want to represent that in Concord.
Dry graduated from high school last year. Now, she's working a part-time job, and she'll start online classes in January. She's running for a House seat in Sullivan District 1, which is one of the most solidly Democratic districts in the state. But Dry is staying optimistic that if she puts in the work, it might be possible to win and complete the plan she laid out for herself when she was just 12. That summer, she went to a camp, learned about writing bills and what it takes to get those to pass through a legislature.
And I fell in love with the process, the formality of the parliamentary procedure. And that's where I decided, I can do this in real life.
So after doing some math, she decided the earliest she could pass bills in real life would be 19. But the fact that Dry is staying in New Hampshire makes her a bit unusual among her friends. A number have gone out of state for college.
What they want to do is just not in the state.
Keeping young people in New Hampshire has been a central concern among business leaders, politicians, schools, and community leaders. It's a big issue to tackle, Dry acknowledges. But she says, instead of just focusing on getting younger people to stay, why not start with making the state house younger?
That was reporter Daniela Ali. I'm here with Daniela now. So I want to talk more about Sophia. Do you know how she got into politics?
Yeah, so she was at a dinner with some other parents, and they were supposed to be talking about family issues, but the conversation turned to politics and what's been going on. And in the course of that conversation, someone turned to her and said, well, you know, maybe you should think about running for state office.
Was this like just a family friend, or was this somebody who had connections, who knew how it worked?
I think it was someone who knew how it worked. She was also friends with Sophia.
Because this is also the kind of thing that your aunt says to you, who's like, you're so smart, you should run.
Right, right. But I think this woman knew a little bit about how to make that happen or where to kind of guide someone.
Okay. Do you think before that person said that, do you think she had thought about running for office? Did it cross her mind?
I don't think so.
Because it's not really a thing that normal people think.
I think, though, she had had a number of years working with Head Start and being involved in her community. Even before she decided to run for state office, she liked talking to her neighbors. She liked knowing what's going on. She liked being outside. She's a super extroverted, commands the room immediately kind of person. And she also had this impression that you needed a business degree or a law degree to run for office. And she was like,
right.
Oh, I can run for office. I don't need to have these particular qualifications. So something that she wanted to check on, though, before she committed to it was checking in with her mom and her husband. They have two young daughters, a third on the way. Can we do this with childcare? Can her husband stay and handle more of the childcare responsibilities? And her mom, I think, lives down the street and she can pitch in too. And they're both like, yeah, you should totally do this. So once she got the green light from them, she's like, okay, I'm going to run and I really want to represent Concord's Ward 8.
Yeah, it's funny what you said about she didn't think that she had the qualifications, which also what I'm hearing there is that she saw politicians on TV or in the news or whatever, and you're like, oh, that's what politicians are. So if they look a certain way, it's kind of self-perpetuating because you're sending a message to everyone out there that if you're not this person, you probably shouldn't run.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So what did she do next? Did she reach out to somebody within a party structure and be like, hey, I want to run?
Yeah. So she reached out to the New Hampshire Young Democrats and they were thrilled. I remember Lucas Meyer, the president of the Young Dems, telling me, he was like, is this for real? Because she meets a lot of what they want to see, young candidate, a woman, mom, she just is representative of a lot of different life experiences that other legislators in Concord, maybe not so much. So that got them really excited, and they've kind of just been supporting her along the way. And honestly, she was a little bit under the radar until the primary, where she beat Democratic incumbent Dick Patton by a 2-to-1 margin.
Which is crazy to me. And I guess I know that smaller elections, sometimes there's a runaway, but still, that's a huge margin.
Yeah, it is huge. And one of the neighbors I talked with while I followed her along canvassing, she's in her early 80s, but she was super pumped to see someone in their late 20s running for office. She's just we just need new energy. We just need to see new people And it doesn't matter how long you've lived in this particular neighborhood. She's like, I can tell that my values line up with Sophia's values. And like, that's what I want to vote for. She's also a refugee from, or was a refugee from Afghanistan.
So the New Hampshire Young Democrats were surprised that this person was knocking on their door. So is this unusual for them? Is this not usually how they get candidates?
Yeah, you think they usually do a little bit more recruitment of candidates.
So like what's the machinery here by which groups like the New Hampshire Young Democrats find young people to be politicians?
I think they've had a couple forums or nights for people who might be interested in running for office. I think it's also in part like word of mouth, honestly, and kind of people finding out, oh, such and such person has this kind of set of qualifications, like let's reach out to them, let's see if they'd be interested, and just like walking them through what the process would be like and like what that means for them, and that you're going to be paid $100 a year and you're going to be working X amount of time in office, and kind of setting that whole framework up so that people are very clear on what they're committing to.
It's got to be a hard sell if you're in your 20s. Because you think about, you know, part of the reason why the legislature is so old is because, you know, like you said, it's basically a volunteer thing. You have to have some means to support yourself. A lot of them are retired because those are the people who have the free time to be a legislator. If you're considering, I don't know, maybe like getting a job or going to college, how do you convince somebody to instead be a politician?
I'm not 100% sure that everyone has an answer to that. And oftentimes, like in Sophia's case, for example, right, she has the support, like her husband's working, so he's making income for the family. She's got her mom's support to take care of her kids and her husband's, right? So she like has the time and the means to do this. There are other handful of people who maybe are also stay-at-home parents. I know there's a stay-at-home dad on the Republican side who's running for office. That slice of the population that doesn't have that, I think that's still missing, right?
Yeah, right.
I know Joe Sweeney, the chairman of the Young Republicans, he was in office when he was a freshman in college, actually. So what he did is he scheduled a lot of his classes on days where he wasn't in committee or during session. And so he made it work for him in that way.
Well, that makes me wonder, you know, exactly what the effect of the 2016 election was in both parties.
So Joe Sweeney told me that people had just been coming out of the woodwork and people just kind of like approaching me like, hey, I'm interested in running.
And he's talking about conservatives.
Yes. And I think some people are excited by what they're seeing or want to see things continue. And I think at the moment they had had a goal of somewhere around like 50 young candidates. And they're, I believe, at 47 young candidates running for office right now.
Hmm.
Between both parties, it's about 100 young candidates total across the state.
One unintended consequence I can imagine of this push, this kind of concerted effort among parties to recruit young candidates, is that maybe those candidates are going to be more reliant on that party that reached out to them. If you are providing them with money and with the staffing and the volunteers and just the information, maybe they're going to then be kind of dependent compared to an older candidate who maybe has some of their own money, their own connections, and their own credibility, their own image.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in some ways, you still kind of need an affiliation no matter what, right? Like you would want a lot of backing from Republicans or from Democrats, even if you are 68, because you want to see kind of like that majority support.
Because that's the thing. You've got these young people coming into office full of ideas and fresh energy and wanting to change things, wanting to make things better. And you just got to wonder, you know, what happens when the rubber meets the road?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't maybe have political experience, do you have the ability to kind of stick by your guns? Because that's hard when it comes into the actual process of legislating.
Right. I think another part of it, though, is that just the numbers game. Like if you just have more young people, because when Joe Sweeney was in office back, I think in 2012, maybe, there were maybe 10 other people. It's like 10 out of 400. Like, what are you really going to be able to get done on in terms of things that young people are really, really caring about?
Mm-hmm.
So I think even if you have a mix of Democrats and Republicans, there will at least probably be like some consensus on what issues need to be talked about to, because I think from both sides I hear young people are leaving the state. Like, what are we actually doing to keep them here? And we're young people and we're in this state. So, like, let's talk about it and let's come up with solutions. And maybe if we just have the numbers game and can build a coalition of young people, then maybe we can start to change what that legislation looks like.
Well, Daniela, thank you for talking.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
It's not just young people trying to raise their numbers in local government. More women are running for office here in New England and across the country. 1 year after the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings in the 1992 midterms, a wave of female candidates ran for office. People called it the Year of the Woman. It was a huge moment for gender representation in Congress. And at the time, the whole subtext was that women bring a perspective to office that men can't. That women are a political group. That gender is political. For many of us, it's always been just that. It's been subtext. In our next story, we're going to be direct and ask, what do women bring to governments? This story comes to us from our friend Erica Heilman over at the podcast Rumble Strip. Erica takes it from here.
This is Rumble Strip. I'm Erica Heilman.
I remember coming through an intersection, and I'm short, and so one of the people I was with picked me up for a minute so I could see above the crowd. And I remember seeing people in every direction as far as I could see. It was a feeling of it was a feeling of an ocean. And I looked out over the sea of people that had come to Washington that day to sort of reclaim America or redefine America. And I knew that all I had to do was raise my hand and say, yeah, I'm a part of this. I want to be a part of this.
That's Kathleen James. She's running for the Vermont House this November. And this is a show about women running for office. It's not about policies or issues. You're not going to learn where these women stand on health care or public education. It's just about the fact of being a woman running for office. And the truth is, I'm tired of hearing about women running for office. I think there's an assumption that I already know why that's a good thing. I mean, we're over 50% of the population, so there's that. But the fact of being a woman running for office, of not being a man running for office, I don't think we're supposed to talk too explicitly about that. So I figured it would be interesting to talk explicitly about that with some women running for office. And it turns out these women had plenty to say, and it also turns out they're all people I'd want to have a beer with. In this show, you'll hear from Kathleen James and Becca White, both running for the Vermont House. You'll hear from Christine Hallquist, a transgender woman and the Democratic nominee for governor, and Ruth Hardy, a candidate for state senate and the executive director of Emerge Vermont, which recruits and trains women to run for office. Here's Ruth Hardy. Why is this topic of women running for office so boring to me?
The topic of the pink wave. I think that the pink wave is kind of sound bitten in a way that it's no longer interesting, in the same way that a really organic story about an individual woman running. We all have our own reasons to run, and the pink wave kind of categorizes us all as one human being that decided to run at the same time. When I talk about myself as a woman running for office, I don't assume that people are going to vote for me because I'm a woman. I assume they're going to vote for me because I'm the best candidate. And that part of the reason I am the best candidate is because of the experiences I've had as a mother and a woman, and because of the experiences I've had in public service in my professional life. And me being a woman is part of that package. And what we need today in politics is the kind of public servant that women tend to be, which is open, which is listening and valuing diverse perspectives and valuing an inclusive process that brings everybody to the table. And that's what women usually do. We have been for centuries doing that. And that's what we're going to continue to do if we're elected.
I really think gender is a social construct.
This is Christine Hallquist.
And we created the social construct of men so they can go to war, right? So we build this, you know, tough, we disconnect from our emotions, our decisions are beyond reproach. That, you know, that's not the way you get the most out of people.
Did you assume when you transitioned that you already understood all of the cultural, gestural aspects of being female? And were you surprised?
No, I never assumed that yet. I knew I was different from a gender standpoint from the day I can remember growing up. I'd received so much abuse as a young child that in ninth grade, I said, I literally remember making the decision, I need to act like a man. And I did. So I acted like a man my whole life. So I had the whole man thing down very well. But the reality is, you know, when I look at the leadership style, I'm going to talk about this and I hope I don't, well, I might offend some men out there, but if I look at the leadership style that we have today, this command and control leadership, it's not very useful. You know, I like to say command and control is great during fire and power outages, but the rest of the time you should be leading through collaboration, right? So, you know, in looking at feminine leadership versus masculine leadership, feminine leadership is so much better for humanity today, especially with the issues we face.
Women are socialized to listen.
Again, here's Ruth Hardy.
You know, how many dates have we been on where our date just talks, and doesn't ask us a damn question? You know, so we listen, and then through listening, you learn a lot about another person, what they're concerned, what they're worried, what their fears are, what their values are and their vision. And I find on the campaign trail, I mentioned I've knocked on over 1,000 doors. And when you knock on the door, you don't know who's going to answer or what's going to be going on with that person behind the door. And this one woman who I talked to a couple weeks ago, she just met me. I'd never met this woman before. And I was standing there in her yard as she was gardening. And she told me about the death of her husband and the death of her mother and how much she missed them. And then she related it to the fact that she really wanted to make sure that medication was affordable. So for me, as somebody who's campaigning, my nugget was, okay, affordable drugs is important. But that connection with her as a human being and that connection about loss and connection about love and loneliness was more important to me than check the box of the policy that she cares about. I think one of the challenges in the world the way it is right now is that we all just want to be heard. And so if I'm showing up and saying, I want to hear you, they're grateful. And on the more sort of practical campaigning level, somebody who feels heard and somebody who feels valued is more likely to vote. And they're also more likely to participate in the process and feel like the process is meaningful to them.
Given how horrible everything is right now, is this an act of faith running for office, that moment can translate into functional government?
Yeah, I think that I believe in our system of government. It's there to serve the people and it's there to be a body of the people. And it needs people who believe in the institution as a force of good, as a force of change, as a force of peace and stability. But our government needs us to believe in it.
This is Becca White. She's running for the Vermont House, and she is also on the select board in Hartford.
The fact is, we're 50% of the population. And if we don't have 50% of the leadership being women, you just don't get that perspective. Like the quote from Alan Kunin is, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. You know, I'll give you an example of our parking lot in Hartford. We have a parking shortage in downtown White River Junction because we're growing and we're thriving. And when I think about the parking lot behind the Legion building, one of the first things that comes to my mind is lighting, because I don't want to walk from my car in the dark to Elixir, the restaurant. I just don't want to do that. I don't feel safe. And if I don't feel safe, I'm not going to go to Elixir that night. If you had a group of people who didn't have that same concern that I do, they're not going to be as concerned about lighting. And it's much better to have someone in leadership say, I can speak to that and let's do it right the first time and not have to have 20 public meetings where people come to us and say, you really should have put that light pole. And guess what? You didn't bring it up because it didn't affect you. And it kind of comes back to that like wait your turn concept, which I think women experience more than men. I think about like the select board is a good example where no one asked me to run for select board, not because I'm not a bright young lady and people know me, but because I don't hang out with select people. I don't hang out with 68-year-old men on my weekends. I hang out with 24-year-old women and my husband. So no one's going to ask me and say, yeah, you should run for select board because you're great and I run into you all the time and we have the same likes and dislikes and I see you. So when I was thinking about running for state rep, particularly men, you're more likely to be in that circle. You're more likely to have a friend say, oh, I'm state rep now, or I know the state rep and you would do great. No one has that conversation with young women because we just literally aren't in the room when those conversations are happening.
Why should Vermonters care? Why should we see this as an asset? Why should they care about this central fact of your, I mean, a keystone piece of who you are?
If you're electing a leader, you want to have a leader who's truly in touch with themselves and not removed from themselves. And so this conversation is really about my life experiences. The conversation, the campaign is about policy. But I will tell you that's interesting about, and I don't know whether this is a female experience or a transgender experience, but I think of the irony of people who talk about gender politics. You listen to a man talk about their experiences. They talk about how they grew up, they went hunting, they went fishing, both parents worked. They talk about their whole history, and it's naturally, you're, as a politician, you're telling your life story. But when I tell my life story, people call it identity politics, right? No, that's my life story. I grew up playing a man. That's the truth. You know, that's not gender politics. That's my life story.
You know, one of the things we talk about training women is, what is the thing you most want voters to know about you? And what do you lead with when you're talking to voters? And I always lead with, I'm a mother of three children. Because my life as an adult, and especially my life in Vermont, I moved here when my oldest was one. So my entire existence in small town Vermont has been as a mother. All of the decisions I've had to make, all of the twists and turns my career and my friendships and my community service have taken have been because of my kids. And they are the thing that would define, I think, in a lot of ways, my work in the legislature and how I work in the legislature. The fact that I can hear multiple voices all the time, like literally hear three people yelling at me at the same time. I can think about the needs of multiple people at the same time. I can take care of, you know, making dinner and helping with homework and doing the laundry all at the same time. You know, I get up in the morning and immediately I'm thinking, what do I have to do in my campaign? Did the kids' lunches get made? You know, did they make the bus or whatever? So there are these things that we're really good at as moms, especially moms with multiple kids, that we've learned over the years from just being moms that we can translate directly into legislative work. You know, the same could be said about dads. I think the role of a father in our society is still different enough that men are not doing the on-the-ground work of parenting that mothers are doing for the most part. Some are, and I think we're seeing change more and more.
There's, you know, people who are like, that is just, I don't want to hear about the mom thing. It's not, what is your answer to that?
The hardest job that I've ever had is being a mom, and I think that almost every mom will tell you that. So if people are skeptical that being a mom is not a skill enough or a job enough to be a legislator, then they've never been a mom.
Again, here's Kathleen James.
There have been two times in my adult life, living here in a small town in rural Vermont, when I knew without a doubt that whoever people thought I was going to change. You know, the first time was when I went from being what I fancied was an upstanding citizen of Manchester Center, Vermont, to someone who was off to rehab. And during that period of my life, I will honestly tell you that there is nothing I wanted more than to take my daughters and move someplace where no one had ever, ever met me, because I felt at times so humiliated. But I had joint custody of two beautiful little girls with a great guy, my ex-husband, and there was no leaving. There wasn't any leaving. And instead of becoming the community of my shame, you know, every day that I stayed sober, Manchester became the place where I was writing a new story of recovery and redemption. That was the first time in my life that I became someone different in a small town. So I had a little bit of practice when it became increasingly clear to me that I was not going to be able to wait 30 years to come out as a gay woman and tell my daughters when they were 50. Because I just didn't want to hurt those kids. I did not want my children to be the daughters of, you know, that crazy lady who's doing something again. And now she's come out. Did you hear about Kathleen James? You know, holy shit. So when it came time to decide about running, the first thing I had to think about was, God, I wonder how I'm viewed in this community. Because it doesn't often matter. I don't think a lot about what people think about me when I'm going to the grocery store or going to pick up my mail or going to a soccer game. I don't walk around thinking, gosh, what do people think about me? You know, what's my reputation? But when it comes time to run, suddenly that question becomes relevant. Well, do people think I'm the kind of person who should run for office? Am I the kind of person people are going to vote for? Gosh, they know I went to rehab. Wow, they know I came out as gay. Geez, they know I'm divorced. And at first I had some thoughts about, well, maybe all those parts of my story make me unqualified to run because I'm not a blameless person and I'm not a perfect person and I'm not the president of the Chamber of Commerce. You know, I'm just this flawed, interesting, I'll give myself that, caring person who feels really passionate about community service and public service. And is that enough? And I'm a mom. Is that enough? And despite this feeling I had of calling and this feeling that I wanted to do it and that I was going to do it, all those powerful feelings I talked about feeling during the Women's March, when it came down to actually announcing or saying, I am going to run for the State House, boy, those devils of doubt start just gnawing right at your spine. And they tell you you're not enough. You know, you're just a woman sitting around in baggy khaki shorts. Like, what the hell are you thinking? But I started to hear a lot of people say, our stories are our power. And you've got a story and you've got some power. Why don't you give it a shot? And that is what I'm trying to do.
We're talking not about issues. We're talking about running for office as a woman. Somebody could say this is even just the fact of this conversation is somehow pulling the woman card. Mm-hmm. Is this a relevant conversation, a relevant topic? Is it worthy of discussion? And why? Why?
I, of course, think it's relevant to have women running and serving in office, especially this year after we had the 2016 election where every card was pulled pretty much and played out of the deck, and some of them in a really horrifying way. I mean, we've seen blatantly sexist, misogynistic campaigning, and women are like, damn it, I'm done with this. I'm going to talk about how I was raped. I'm going to talk about how I was overlooked for a promotion or a job. I'm going to talk about how I don't get paid as much as my male counterparts. I'm going to talk about all of it. I'm going to pull every single woman card, because every single card was pulled against women in 2016. And it's fair also because of the conversation we just had about how there are strengths that women bring to the table that men can't bring to the table. And so saying, hey, look, there are some things that I can do that you can't do. And the reason I can do them is because I'm a woman, or because I'm a mom, or because I've had these life experiences that you don't have. That's completely fair. Men have pulled the male card for all of eternity. Our whole entire existence in this world, our entire human history, has been about men pulling the men card. And now it's time for us to pull the woman card. We need to be in elected office and we need to be represented. It's time. We're fed up.
I genuinely believe that on the day I die, I'm going to look back and know that America rolled forward like a wave, that the wave receded and we took a big scary step backwards, and that then all the people in this country of both parties who genuinely believe in the same things and genuinely believe in the ideals of this country took a deep breath and pushed a huge wave forward that's going to take us beyond where we were before. I believe that, and it's why I'm running. And I think I'm going to see it. And I think we're all going to see it.
Producer Erica Heilman. You can hear more of her excellent podcast, Rumble Strip, at rumblestripvermont.com. This episode was produced by me, Ben Henry. Our staff includes Jimmy Gutierrez, Justine Paradise, and Jackie Helbert. Our executive producer is Erica Janik. Music in this episode from Maiden and Blue Dot Sessions. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.